Hello and welcome to The Media Show. I'm Brenda Power, and in today's episode, Reinventing Public Media. How will the new broadcasting charge actually work?
People paying the TV licence have nothing to fear, whereas those who have been evading up to now, it will make their lives a little bit more difficult.
The broadcasting regulator says presenters shouldn't use the airwaves for personal platforms.
I don't buy into the whole thing that it's muzzling of people.
And social media. Should you be allowed to make anonymous comments? But first, it is the most listened to radio programme in Ireland, with nearly 500,000 people tuning in every day, and it's been on air now for nearly 30 years. So on Tuesday, we got up very early and joined the Morning Ireland team and online editor Lisa Pereira to see behind the scenes and find out how Morning Ireland is finding a new audience via podcasts, web cameras and social media.
Hi, Brenda.
Hi, Lisa. How are you?
Pleased to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
I think you know Laura. You know Vincent.
Good morning. It's 7 o'clock on Tuesday, the 9th of April. This is Morning Ireland on RTE Radio 1 with Cathal McCullough and Gavin Jennings.
Today, Richard Bruton on the report that says lower tax rates would be good for business. Former British Cabinet Minister Edwina Curry on the Prime Minister, they're still arguing about.
We became aware that we couldn't just be a radio programme anymore. Media was changing. People were demanding to be able to hear Morning Ireland material at a time that suited them, not at a time that suited RTE. I'm Lisa Pereira. My title is studio and web producer, which means that I'm in charge of what's happening outside. And then both during and after the programme, actually also before the programme, I'm also trying to get as much material as we can online to be able to offer our listeners, both in Ireland and abroad, ways of listening and getting material that would enhance the types of stories that we're doing.
The headlines on Toshka has said that poor air quality is contributing to shortening the lives of 3,400 people.
I'm Cathal McCullough. I'm one of the presenters of Morning Ireland.
You've been on Morning Ireland off and on pretty much since it started. How has it changed with the onset of digital?
I think we learned very quickly now, during the programme, literally, what people think, how they're reacting, what they feel should have been in the programme or should not have been. All that's to the good. I mean, you've got to filter some of it, but it's much, much better than waiting sometimes hours, sometimes even days for the reaction to a programme.
Phil Hogan and the Minister for Health, James Riley.
But you need to hear what listeners are thinking, and the good thing about social media and about the fact that we are now online as well as reaction to it is that you hear it very quickly, and that's very useful as a journalist.
Conditions which can particularly affect the very young and elderly.
Yeah, the podcasts are actually a really important part of what we offer. What we do is we segment the whole programme so that you can listen to every single item individually. We also have the listen back function on our website, which allows you to just listen to the whole 2 hours as if it was live. We've noted that this is really important, particularly to our listenership abroad. They would download the Morning Ireland podcast in the morning and put it in their car and listen to it on the way to work.
Okay, Cathal, just to let you know, we're coming to the Avon story after sport.
I'm Vincent Murphy, I'm one of the editors on Morning Ireland. One of the great frustrations of a show like Morning Ireland is that each item has maybe 5 to 8 minutes at max, and sometimes there's so much more you'd like to say. The great thing about the website or about social media is you can share that information again in a way that people will be able to look it up.
The death of Savita Halatanavar
resumed
Galway this morning.
I'll take that if you want.
Hello, Morning Ireland. University
Hospital. Lisa, of course, you've got the TV cameras in the studio now. How has that changed?
Well, that was quite a radical change for us, and we hope for our listeners, in that the delineation between radio and television just isn't there anymore. That, I think, has, we hope, added value in that it gives listeners an insight into the operation, what Morning Ireland is, how it's put together, how it operates, and of course it allows them to see the presenters and also to see the guests.
There are, of course, two very opposing views of Margaret Thatcher.
Cathal, you tweet quite a lot, and you even tweet while you're on air. How important is that for your interaction with the listeners?
I tweet simply to give people an idea of what's coming up on the programme.
Call her a champion of freedom for work.
I only started a year ago when we had a session with a consultant who had been an advisor to the Today programme, our parallel programme on the BBC, who came in to sort of say to them, this is what you could do with social media. And she pointed out ways in which it could be used.
Now, you see, there's a perfect example of some information which has come into us which I'm now going to check.
First of all, by Edwina Curry, who was appointed by Margaret Thatcher as a junior minister in her government in the 1980s. Edwina Curry, good morning.
Good morning, Colin.
That was a perfect illustration of how useful Twitter can be. I mean, we made a mistake. Somebody has tweeted in. I think we identified Edwina Curry as a former cabinet minister. She wasn't a former cabinet minister, she was junior health minister, so that error won't be repeated. It seems extraordinary to me now that there was a time when Morning Ireland and every radio program was just live radio. That was it.
That was our standing invitation to you. If you have anything you want to say about issues...
Morning Ireland has changed quite dramatically over the last few years, and we would like to think that it's changed for the better.
The time now is coming up to 9 o'clock. It's time to hand over to...
So you can see how Morning Ireland is using social media, not just to connect with listeners and keep them up to speed, but also, and you heard Lisa say it there, sometimes themselves being pulled up by their listeners. While Morning Ireland remains the jewel in the RTE crown, it has been a turbulent year for the station, with both a financial deficit and the fallout from that editorial crisis in news and current affairs, and RTE's troubles are not over yet either. In recent weeks, the station has faced criticism over its presenter salaries, and a BAI review of RTE's value for public money is due to reach the minister's desk shortly. Well, I'm joined by the Minister for Communications, Pat Rabbit. Minister, you are reviewing public broadcasting in the run-up to your new broadcasting charge. When's that likely to come in?
I don't see us being ready to go before 2014. Believe it or not, there are more knots in the system to be unravelled. It's not quite as simple as it sounds. In any event, some four other countries are in the process at the moment, and hopefully it will mean that we don't have to reinvent the wheel. But I think 2014 is a reasonable target. I suppose I should emphasise that it is a replacement for the TV licence, because every time I say anything about this, I get a list of abuse saying, my God, not another charge. And I get emails complaining about another charge. It's not another charge. It's a replacement. Hopefully, in terms of the efficacy of collection, it will be better, because there is about 15-16% evasion at the moment, which is, you know, well in excess of 20 million. And hopefully a universal charge would perhaps enhance the fund that is available.
So how do you see collection working then? Will it be linked to the household charge, for instance?
I think it would be wise, Brinda, to avoid that and the perception that might attach to that. I think it will still be a standalone charge expressly to support public service broadcasting. How to collect it, I think, you know, in all probability, that may well have to go to tender. You know, if you avoided the situation where those of us who are compliant are paying for those who evade, I think people would see the fairness of it. I think people acknowledge that they do access content in other than the traditional way, that it's merely coming into line with that.
But how do you think in the current climate people who are already facing taxes for property, taxes for water, are going to respond to this charge? You will get, look, I don't watch RTE, or they're all overpaid in there anyway.
No, you're right. You will get both of those complaints. The correspondence that I get on this complaining about I don't watch RTE, the email traffic usually betrays a greater knowledge of what's on RTE than I have. So I'm a bit sceptical about that. I mean, I think public service broadcasting is important. I think public service content is important. I think expressly Irish broadcasting is important. We are Irish, after all. We're not Americans. We're not Australians. And I really wouldn't make any apology for wanting to fund public service broadcasting. You know, the content is there now to be accessed in different ways. I mean, in the context of people being subjected to a property tax, people having to pay for the creation of a water utility down the line, it's not the most congenial time to do it. I shouldn't say, but maybe if I hint that it won't be more than the TV licence, then people paying the TV licence have nothing to fear, whereas those who have been evading up to now, it will make their lives a little bit more difficult.
Now, the independent broadcasters, the IBI, say that they welcome this charge, but they want more of it to go to them.
Well, it is true that the members, or at least some members of the IBI, the independent broadcasters, the regional stations, are suffering in the present climate. It is true also that they do public service content. And I think that should be acknowledged. They're very loyal audiences. They do work of public service merit. It's also true to say that they are commercial enterprises. I remember Mary Harney describing the licenses at the time as a license to print money. They were much sought after commercial enterprises at the time. The TV license or the new public service broadcasting charge cannot be a panacea for the problems that affect the modern day media landscape across the entire terrain. You know, I've had pretty much everybody in the sector coming to talk to me about disbursements from the TV license fund. Even some newspaper people have suggested that given the undoubted constraints within which they're operating at the moment, the challenge of technology and so on, that the license fund again might be dispersed productively to keep important newspapers in circulation. Now, I'm all in favour of keeping important newspapers in circulation, but I can't really work out the mathematics that would suggest that a more generous disbursement of largesse from the TV license fund would be able to solve all of the problems that confront media in 2013.
But while RTE can still benefit from the dual funding model, certainly the radio stations have a point, don't they? I mean, they have 67% of the national listenership compared to RTE's 32%. 58% of adults listen to local radio. Surely there's some argument there.
I think in any revamp of public service funding, I think government would have to take that into account. I am likely to receive a report from the BAI within the next 4 to 6 weeks to do with value for money and public service broadcasting. I look forward to that because I think the point you make is well made, that they have substantial, loyal audiences. They do public service content, but there are other factors as well that have to be taken into account. There are also arguments that suggest that rather than talking about the TV fund as such, that, for example, there could be a more creative use of the Sound and Vision Fund. The Sound and Vision Fund is a separate fund that comprises some 7% of the TV licence total, and that it should be possible to look at that in terms of making a contribution to the broadcasting landscape generally, and in the process maybe making life a bit more easy for more ready access to that fund. But it's not something that I have a settled position on yet.
Can I move on to the issue of media ownership? You've said yourself, diversity of ownership is more important in the media than any other enterprise because it has such an impact on the quality of our democracy. What's the state of play with the media mergers legislation? We've been hearing about this for some time now.
Yeah, it's some time since government approved the heads of a bill. It hasn't emerged. That seems to be purely a function of the legislative schedule. The revamp of competition law, of which the media sections comprise part, is a fairly major piece of legislation by my colleague Richard Bruton. He got approval for the heads of it more than a year ago now, and I understand is on record as saying it will be published this term.
And that would transfer to you responsibility for media mergers, making you basically Minister for the Media.
At the moment, responsibility in the area that you raise, you know, is a matter essentially for the Competition Authority. The heads of the bill, as approved by government, transfers responsibility for all media to the Department of Communications. The new law, I think, certainly in terms of the input that we have made, and we have made repeated input and we have made written input, would have very high regard to the Schreenen principles. That was the advisory group on media that reported some number of years ago now and wasn't implemented. But that does treat media as different from other sectors of industry or commerce because of the influence that media has on public discourse and because of the influence that media has on democracy itself. It is different.
But are you comfortable as minister with the shape of the current media ownership landscape?
There is nothing comfortable about being a minister at this time, in this place, in this country. So I'm not comfortable at all. But you have to take the shape of the media landscape as we have it. and you have to see, do they pass the public interest test that will be at the top of the Srinan principles that I talked to you about? And everybody will have an opinion on how well government is policing that or otherwise.
Now, this week, the Broadcasting Authority published its Code of Fairness, but has abandoned plans for a draft code that would have seen broadcasters and editors publish a register of their professional and financial interests. The BII say you have to act before they can do so. Are you going to act?
I don't know yet enough whether they steered away from that issue because of representations from people who are actually in those positions. I suspect that's the cause. I certainly would like to get time to assess that now that it's in the public domain. I didn't get any pre-notice of it or anything else, nor indeed should I. But it is in my lap now, that's true, and I will have to examine it. I would have thought that it would be worth hearing the BAI as to why they have come down as they have. Because, you know, there are other implications for taking the opposite course in terms of the freedom of presenters and programme makers to do what they think they ought to do, again, in the public interest. So I'm certainly very happy to have a look at it now that it's in the public domain.
Minister for Communications Pat Rabbitt there. John Purcell, you are Chief Executive of local radio station KCLR. You're also the Chairman of the IBI. You represent independent television and radio broadcasters in Ireland. From your perspective, is this new broadcasting charge a good thing?
We think it's a necessary move. The level of evasion of television licence and the method of funding broadcasting isn't effective and it needs to be improved. Equally, the range of platforms on which media is consumed has changed enormously, and we think a television licence as such isn't appropriate into the future. Equally, evasion is an issue, and so a more effective and efficient way of collecting the licence is a good idea. We think that RTE is at a bit of a tipping point in relation to its funding. Equally, however, we think that the funding of broadcasting in general and all public service broadcasting, not just through the state sector, needs to be addressed. And so we think that this presents a huge opportunity for exciting reform to serve the listening public.
But you want a slice of it, and the minister told us here on the media show that in any revamp of the public funding of content, and he indicated that's what he's planning to do, he will be looking at your case in the IBI.
Yeah, well, I think we've been having a lot of discussions with the minister, and we've been very pleased with his recognition of the role of independent broadcasters. We provide a lot of public service content. I think it's important to note that the issue of providing funding from the licence fee to independent broadcasters is not new, and it's something that's been done for quite a while through the Sound and Vision scheme. In the implementation of a broadcasting charge, there should be and could be an increase in the funding that will come from the charge, and we think that this should be looked at and that the public service broadcasting that independent broadcasters do should be supported.
Is there not a danger, though, that you could spread it too thinly, especially with the newspapers now saying that they want a bite?
Yeah, there's always a question of spreading resources too thinly, and our policy position is not just that independent broadcasters need to have access to some of the licence fee, which we already do through Sound and Vision, but that RTE needs to focus on its public service remit. And I think that instead of spreading itself too thinly, RTE needs to focus very much on the stuff that it can do to the exclusion of anybody else can do. RTE, in terms of RTE television, would appear to have one of the highest proportions of bought-in American and international drama of any so-called public service broadcaster in Europe. We think that RTE should be focusing on the things that are special to RTE and that RTE can do better than anybody else, and we'd have no problem in saying that.
Now, John, this week we also had the release of the BAI's new Fairness and Objectivity Code for broadcasters. Now, it got headlines straight away, as you know, because it pulled back from the proposed register of presenter interests, saying that the minister would have to act first in order to allow this. But it has put in place clear new conditions for broadcasters, including, obviously, your members. So what do you make of it?
You know, we felt that in relation to the register of interests, what was being proposed was using a sledgehammer to crack a nut, for want of a better expression. We suggested a range of ameliorations to what was suggested at the time. We feel that what's come out is actually sensible. We feel that the public is nothing to fear from what's there. We believe that the industry acts in good faith in relation to conflicts of interest and so on. And so overall, we feel it's a sensible document. the implementation of it will be key, and there is another important step whereby the Commission will develop guidance notes, and that will be another process that we'll engage in very actively, and hopefully we will see balanced and rational implementation of these codes.
But what do you make of the headlines suggesting that this is going to mean our broadcasters will be muzzled?
I don't buy into that, to be honest. I think it's important to read the code and to take account of it, and what the code says has to be viewed in the context of the wide range of other legislation that broadcasters have to operate into. I suppose the headline was that broadcasters wouldn't be able to voice their own opinion. I don't read it like that. As with anything, the key to it is how that's going to be implemented and how it's going to be monitored, and we'll be pushing very strongly to ensure that presenters of current affairs can operate in as unfettered way as possible.
John Purcell of the IBI there. But whatever the broadcasters think, it is we, the public, who'll be forking out for this new charge. Mark Cullinane is a media researcher at UCC, and in our Media Watch column, he makes the case for the public to be put back into public broadcasting.
The ads currently running on the airwaves remind us how many ways there are to pay our TV licence. What they don't tell us is why we should pay it at all. It is no longer self-evident that the concept of public media, or public anything for that matter, is a good thing. The public realm is under threat in an increasingly privatised age. The government is planning on replacing the current television licence fee with yet another tax, a universal public service broadcasting charge. With many more people being compelled to pay, RTE will have to convince people that they should. The case for public service broadcasting will have to be made all over again. This requires a new vision of public service media. What will this look like, and who should determine that vision? I think that if we're serious about democracy, the only acceptable answer is that the public must be brought into the equation. Right now, the public's main role in public media is that of the passive consumer of programming and as eyeballs for advertising. Certainly, we can complain and maybe even talk to Joe, but for the most part, we are shut out of decision-making. Formal accountability like annual reports and charters have their place, but are not a replacement for meaningful public participation. It really shouldn't be too much to ask. We pay the bills, after all.
Now, I should say that Mark Cullinane is a member of the RTE Audience Council, but he contributed that opinion in a personal capacity. And if you have any thoughts for a Media Watch column, let me know. Email us at mediashow@rte.ie, or indeed if you have any views or stories that you want to share, join the conversation on Twitter using hashtag RTE Media Show.
I think it's important that everybody realises that what is illegal offline is illegal online.
Sinead McSweeney of Twitter there, addressing the joint Oireachtas committee when social media platforms like Twitter and Facebook were summoned to account for themselves a few months back, following growing concerns over cyberbullying and the impact of nasty and often anonymous comment or trolling online. I've been talking to media lawyer Andrea Martin on the subject of social media and the law, but first I asked Minister Pat Rabbitt if he believed social media needed additional regulation or even legislation.
The defamation law applies to online just as it does to traditional media. There may well be areas where the law can be finessed. I raised myself in my contribution before the committee, for example, the question of takedown policy. I shouldn't have thought that it would be necessary to legislate for that, given that you have few, small, large-scale world players that ought to, as an act of good citizenship, have an arrangement agreed in individual jurisdictions that, for example, there would be a speedy response to takedown requests where there is a manifest case for doing that. But the Oireachtas Committee has not reported yet. They did hear a very interesting cross-section, and I think it was evident that their thinking evolved as that went along. I mean, there may well be a case for the Press Council of Ireland to have a look at what role it can play in terms of established online producers making themselves amenable to Press Council rules. The BAI has a role. It may well be that the BAI legislation ought to be updated. But it is an area that does require clarity, and as soon as the Oireachtas Committee reports, I will have to look at that.
So, Andrea Martin, we just heard the minister there say he is waiting for the committee's report. Now, you yourself, you follow the hearings. So the Twitter people themselves say there's no real difference between online and offline comment. And given the very legitimate concerns about online bullying, about abusive material, what is their case?
The big social media providers, obviously, from a business model point of view, want to take as hands-off an approach as possible. It's cost-intensive, labour-intensive, it impedes the free flow of information to have to go around looking for material to take it down. So naturally, they are lobbying for a regime that will allow them to take as hands-off an approach as possible. Now, they're coming up against the civil law from the point of view of defamation, breach of copyright. They're coming up against data protection law. I think we're all aware that Facebook has its European headquarters in Ireland.
And what is the deal with anonymous comment on, for instance, the likes of Ask FM? Do you think people should be allowed to keep their identities hidden?
This whole issue of anonymity is a very, very vexed one. And I don't think the answer is clear cut. You have digital rights activists, many of whom would have a lot of respect, who maintain that anonymity is an essential part of the free flow of information, of holding power to account at an international and political level. At the same time, anonymity is used as a cloak for appalling bullying, cowardice and online abuse. What I think we're going to see is that credible sources of information and commentary, sources that want to be regarded as having integrity and credibility, will give their real identity, will present themselves as they really are, will render themselves available to be traced. I mean, that's the hallmark of credibility.
Andrea Martin. I'm Brenda Power, and you've been listening to The Media Show. Next week, how Netflix is playing havoc with television's business model.
It's often younger people who access television content in this way.
And don't forget, you can listen back to the programme as a podcast on the RTE website.